Concession number 17620, James Watts, Rio 10.
Mr. Watts, Reel 10. We're talking about the quality of the German soldier, and you said you got to admire them. Admire them for what? Exactly what was it that brought on this admiration, although they were your enemies?
Well, I can best answer that with a joke. A joke of Bob Hope. He said, in war, the infantry have nothing to do. He says, the aeroplanes go over, and the plaster the place with high explosives. He says, and then the naval guns come up and they fire their huge shells. He says, and the huge cliffs are turned into big boulders. And then the artillery have a go and they turn the boulders into big stones. And then the tanks come in, they grind the stones into little stones, into pebbles. He says the place is flattened and there's nothing left for the infantrymen to do but to go in and do all the fighting. That's how I think of the German soldier. And that's precisely, you know, what happened later at Cassino. We bombed them with 700 and odd planes. We shelled them with 700 and odd guns. We sent the tanks in who couldn't get through the huge craters made by the huge bombs, etc. And when we went in with the infantry, the Germans were still there.
You're with 78 Division. What brigade were you in?
11 Brigade. 11 British Infantry Brigade. We had three brigades. 11 Brigade had the Lancashire Fusiliers, the Northamptons and the Surreys. 36 Brigade was the West Kents, the Buffs and the Argyll and Southern Highlanders. And then we had a brigade of Irishmen, Ulstermen and Irishmen from Southern Ireland. We had the Skeens, the London Irish Rifles, Royal Irish Fusiliers. And that was a very, very fightingest brigade of them all, I think. It was a very good brigade.
Can I now come back to your very first action, the crossing of that river, I think, that you mentioned?
Yeah.
What are your memories of that?
Well, crossing the Trigonore was just a matter of course, because somebody had obviously made a bridgehead and we just followed into it. But when we came to the Sangro...
Did you cross by wading? Or
well, just waded through. Or? Just waded through. But when we came to the Sangro, that was the beginning of November.
What was the terrain like that you were moving and fighting through?
Well, you can picture the... Italy is, of course, something similar to England. You've got the Pennines in England, you've got the Apennines in Italy. Now, Gran Sasso in Italy, and that's on the south-east corner of the mountain range, it's about 8,500 feet high. Now, once you get up to the Sangro, Castel di Sangro, and then across to Cassino, you come into the mountainous country and it comes down very, very abruptly to the sea. So you've got mountains and you've got coast on the right hand side, and that's where the 8th Army were. On the other side, it's a bit more sloping to the sea from the mountains, and that's where you've got, that's where the 5th Army were.
Americans?
Yes, with a lot of British divisions. So that.
So where were the Germans' positions in relation to your own in this mountainous area?
Well, they were in the mountains in different places.
Were they always above you?
Yes, they'd be observing us quite clearly. They had the advantage of observation. But when we approached the Sangro, of course, it's more or less flat, but the Sangro is quite a big basin. Now, we crossed over on about November the 21st, and we made the bridgehead. We established the bridgehead over the side.
So was that under fire?
Yes, we were artillery fire, mortar fire.
What's it like being under artillery and mortar fire?
Well, you've got a point to go for, and you want to get to there as quickly as possible. And one of the things you must do when you reach there is dig in. You've got to dig in, throw the muck well back. Now, when we got to the Sangro, we crossed over. The river was in spate. We had to carry our weapons above our heads. And I was wading through, and I went down a hole, and I was completely submerged. And this is in the start of the Italian winter, you know. The worst winter that the Italians remember. We waded through the river, and the point of leaving the river, you go up the bank, well, all the lads in front of you are wet through. As they're going up the bank, they're draining off, and the bank becomes a slippery slope. So some of you go up, and you see them going the way, coming back down into the river again. There's quite a lot drowned. I think we lost about 5 men drowned there. And then when we got on the top of that particular point, a platoon had gone on in front of us, and we were the next platoon. And as we were making our way across, there was a series of flashes. I realised it wasn't artillery, and I couldn't hear the swish of the mortar bomb. And a voice said, "Stand still, everybody, we're in a minefield." Now, the platoon in front, I lost one of my mates. The 3 of us had joined Gang Fusiliers in October. In November, we said goodbye to one of them.
Who was that?
A lad called Matt Neal, Billy Matt Neal from Gateshead. And I never saw him anymore. I haven't been able to find out whether he's was wounded or whether he's killed. But I never saw him anymore, and I haven't seen him at the reunion, so I fear the worst for him. But we said goodbye quick.
What do the effects of the words "we're in a minefield" on soldiers?
Well, you freeze.
I mean, I'm throwing it freezing, but maybe internal emotional effects.
That's right. No, the sergeant says, "Right, lads, now try and follow the one in front. Put your feet where he's put his feet." And the next thing we knew, we were out of it. Came to a bit of a road which led to a bridge which had been blown. And then we came into battle. We went into battle. The Germans were on top of the escarpment, and we went for them. And we got to the top, and I remember the officer saying, "Right, well, lads, dig in." And as we started to dig in, we were getting showered with grenades. And I said, "Well, where are they coming from?" You know. So we moved off the positions and a bit farther forward and came round the back. And what it was, there's the escarpment. Just over the top, the Germans are entrenched. Well, they've got a roof over their entrenchment, and they're just throwing grenades over like this. And we're trying to dig in here. Well, we're only about 3 yards from them. Coupled, of course, there was somebody not far away firing grenades, discharging them from a rifle throwing grenade. Are you with me? And anyhow, we captured the position, we took a number of prisoners, shot some.
What are your memories of the actual battle situation itself? I mean, the actual fighting, the noise, the yelling, the screaming, the shouting, what have you. What are your memories of that in action?
Well, it's chaos. It's in the dark.
This was a night attack,
you,
was it?
You don't know what's happening, really. And that's when I got the message that I hadn't got to fire, was on the occasion that I hadn't got to fire this Smyther with rapid fire. I could fire single shots, you know, but not rapid fire, because it gives the impression that the people are behind you. But you see, we'd formed a crescent, and our company, A Company, had taken the escarpment, and it went round in a circle to the right and then bending back. And at the top of the bend, about 300 yards away, there was a machine gun, and he was firing at us, and I directed the 2-inch mortar at him, and the first bomb I put in, it was on very, very soft ground. And when it fired, it went straight up and dropped about 6 yards in front. But the next shot, I got it in the right direction, and they took off the, you could see the machine gunners. They were getting fired at all the time. One unusual incident there was watching a lad from Newcastle, ex-DLI, not my battalion, and he had a pick in his hand. He was chasing a German soldier. But I don't know what happened.
They were wounded?
The colonel was wounded. He had quite a big gap down his left thigh.
Who was he?
Right thigh. Colonel McKenzie. A grand lad. One of the best. He just died in 1985.
Hearing wounded, obviously they're making some noise of some kind, other. Does that affect you?
Well, the British soldiers pretty good. There's some might be shouting because of fear, but I don't think they're shouting because of fright or even hurt. But I think that was one of the most tragic things. Was I watched a man die beside me who had a bullet in his head. I couldn't help him. That was a lad called Jack Eves. And the company man who was killed. We had quite a lot of casualties there, and we held those positions.
Some of the scenes of wounds must have been quite horrific that you were seeing around you.
Well, the worst, I don't think a bullet, I mean, if I was to be wounded, I'd rather have a bullet. But when you see a lad with a big gash across his chest and he's got a lump of shrapnel in it, and the maggots are already entertaining them, doing them good, actually, begging to be shot, and about 3 months later he's with you again. You can't forget those things.
How do you cope?
You don't. You get on with it. I think that's one of the things I must applaud our lads for. They weren't soldiers. They were lads who'd gone to fight because somebody had attacked them and they had to beat the enemy. And I reckon the lads who, there were civilians in khaki, they were good lads too. They were good lads. I was very proud of them. I was proud to be with them. And on reflection, we were, and there was, when we captured that position, by the way, we were there for 5 days. We were cut off. We couldn't get supplies. We had no tea. I mean, to go without your tea, you know, that's worse than being shot at. Very little food. We had to live off what we'd taken with us. So we were there for 5 days, and then we were relieved by the 8th Indian Division.
Were you under fire all those five days?
Yes, we were fired at with the enemy weapons and mortar fire. But I'll tell you what, towards our right, where I'd taken one of my patrols, the Indians were building a bridge across the railway. It was 3/4 of a mile long. That was the second largest Bailey Bridge built during the war. And I can still remember those being strafed by the Luftwaffe. The carrying on working.
Shell fire and mortar fire is somewhat anonymous, isn't it? It's not aimed at one person, it's just shot in amongst you. What effect does it have on you when you're actually under shell fire and mortar fire? Do you think that every shell's heading your way? Or
well, I
how do you cope with it?
I remember one of the lads says, you know, he says, sometimes when I walk across the field, he says, I feel like a magnet. He says, and every bit of metal that Jerry's got is coming towards me. He was killed. Bill Layton.
But then coming, you know, shells raining down on you, what's your initial reaction? What do you want to do?
You go down like a mole. But one of the most important things that you learn is the degree of cover necessary to sustain your existence. If you're in a little shallow and a bomb goes off about a yard or two away from you, you know, you might get a waft of a big puff, but you're not hurt. I think one of the worst things that ever happened to me was blown up and coming down, you know, you go up as high as the ceiling, and when you come down, you hit the deck, and there's a splatter of dust and that, and all, every bit of skin you've got is stinging, and you're deafened, and you're a bit cock-eyed, you know, and you're blustered, and you're... And then somebody, I heard somebody shout, over here, Geordie, over here. And then, of course, I took off and I just fell into the slit trench and I fainted. And that happened to me three, I'd blown off my feet three times. Not
that
touched, you know.
It's horrifying.
It is, because you know, the German bombs, mortar bombs, weren't as big as ours. They were 81 millimetre, but... They used to rain them down on us like hailstones, you know. But the mortar, you know, it peels, the bomb peels, and you get the lump of shrapnel. That's deadly. That lad I was telling you about who had the shrapnel in his chest, we shouted for the stretcher bearers, and two of the lads come across. No, there's a good set of lads, stretcher bearers, wonderful. And he just pulled, like... a 2-stone sugar bag of white powder, just put it on, bandaged them up, send them back. I think that was sulfonamide, I'm not quite sure. But he was back.
They were well respected.
Oh yes, brave lads. I mean, but there again, I can relate a story to you, which I will later, of how the white flag and the red flag are respected by some troops. But not all.
This is the Red Cross.
Yes.
Did you see anyone break? Under the stress of shellfire, mortaring, and so forth.
Oh yes, I broke myself. But
what do you think brings that about?
Futility. I mean, to sit in a hole for 33 days. And not dare move during the day. You don't put your hand up. If you leave it for 5 seconds, it'll be shot, your hand. So what's going to happen if you stand up? You're deprived of water, you're deprived of washing facilities. It's cold, it's wet. The enemy's only about, the other side of that hedge, about 50 yards away. And he's a very resourceful man. He's not just anybody. He's a tough guy. And then you see blokes that you've been talking to being whittled away one by one. It only takes so much.
And you feel, as time goes on under those conditions, situations, that it must be getting closer to your time?
Yes.
Is that always with you?
Well, like I said, if I'd read that there's 2,800 men that passed through the Langfuse Lees in 2 years, I would have been very, very wondering what it was all about. That's why they were short of platoon commanders. The expectancy of life of a platoon commander was very short indeed. In fact, I'm not quite sure, but I believe the expectancy of life of the British soldier in Italy was more high than that in the First World War. Because we used to have a saying, we're not eating today and gone tomorrow, we eat today and gone tonight.
Looking at your personal situation when you say you nearly broke, do you feel it coming on?
Yes.
Is something happening to you?
Yes.
What is it?
Like I said, it's futility. You sit there, all you've got to do is you contemplate. You know, one of the best places for contemplation is in the toilet, because you're on your own. You sat there, you're on your own, and you say to yourself, what am I doing here? You're just existing to stop somebody from getting some territory. That's going to be no good to him when he gets it. Or you sat there waiting for somebody to come and storm through you and they'll put in the attack. But it's fearsome, and...
Did you ever have feelings that you might not survive, as evidently some men did have?
Often. I mean, I met my wife in 1942, but I wouldn't get serious when I knew I was going abroad. No way. I didn't think I would come back. I didn't expect to come back.
How did this break point, what was the actual effect upon you at the break point time? What were you doing? I mean, I don't mean thinking of that, but I mean the actual physical and emotional situation.
Well, this is a very poignant part of my life, this. It's a thing which I've struggled with for a long time. We were short of water and we discovered a well at the bottom of the positions where we were. And the water party would go down with the German invented, the old jerry can. And the lads would wrap them up in blankets so that if they dropped they didn't make a noise. Because if they made a noise, we got shelled with hand grenades and water bombs and what have you. So the lads had gone down for the water and the stunk started. The Germans had opened up with their mortars and the bombs were dropping all around. And that was one when I was in my abri. It's a little shelter, you know. A sangha. A bomb had dropped about 2 yards away from me, maybe closer, but it didn't affect me. And I got up because I heard some yells and shouts. And in the dark, I came across a body. That man was lying there, and I felt him, and I knew, I spoke to him, and I knew he was dead, and I thought was my best mate. And I got back in my hole, and meanwhile the lads are coming back with the water. And come the morning, I realised it wasn't me mate, it was another lad. My mate had come back with the water and he was okay. It was another lad, and I was glad that it wasn't my mate, but it was some other lad, some other son lad. And he was one of those lads who used to go around. He had a lovely voice. He always used to be singing Trees or The Rose of Tralee and songs like that. And I felt that that was wrong for me. I was glad my mate was still alive. Are you with me?
Yeah, but did you get to a situation where you felt you couldn't even move? You couldn't move from wherever you were, you didn't want to move?
Well, if the
or
Germans...
even go back, of course.
I tell you what I would have done. If the Germans had attacked, I would have been there. I would have been fighting them. I wanted to have a go. It wasn't that I was keen on fighting. But what's the point of sitting in a hole if you're not going to do anything? But our orders were that we had to just hold the position until we built up strength. Now, it follows that, and I've read my regimental history, divisional history, our battalion was going to attack that part of the front. And when I say a battalion, you've got to imagine that it's about three companies of men, three depleted companies, not full strength companies. So we're talking of about 300 men going in. And when you consider that was the position, that was what we were going to do, and then you match that with what really happened, when a brigade of Poles did what our three companies were going to do, three battalions were going to do, and I mean the poor Poles were massacred. They had over 2,000 casualties. And a feature of that is that I believe they're buried without a memorial on the top of the monastery.
Is it easier then, is this what you're saying, is it easier then to be involved in action?
Yes.
Than sitting out of it?
Yes, because I think all men are soldiers. We're all hunters. I mean, it must be inherent in our blood. And I mean, if I get in the ring with a man, he hits me, I hit him back. But if I can't do that, what's the point of getting in the ring? But eventually, you see, we put the big push in, and the Poles captured the monastery, and their big red and white flag flew over the top. Another great soldier, the Pole. They were all good. The French were good. French soldiers were good in Italy. The Free French.
So you came, as you say, you were fighting through mountainous country.
Yeah.
This is winter.
Yes.
And a very bad winter.
It's coming of spring, actually. I remember that when we moved in, we got in like a little natural basin. And when I woke up, there was snow on my face. It was April.
Was that the first snow that you'd come across?
Oh, no. We'd been up in the mountains in 1943.
How did you cope with the mud and the bitter cold?
The mud. I was on about earlier about Castel di Sangro and the River Sangro and our attacker on the bridgehead, making the bridgehead. When we came out, the track that was to take us to the rear was about 2 foot high, deep, of mud. Pure watery mud. And about half a dozen little Gurkhas were trying to shovel it away. Well, you can't shovel water away, it just runs back. Anyhow, when we came out of the line, we'd had a hell of a set to, you know. I mean, it was a good battle. The little Gurkhas, four of them, put their shovels at the slope and gave us butt salutes. And we, in single file, as we went to the rear, the set to each and every one of them was, "Well done, Johnny." Of course, there's another great soldier, isn't it?
Did you take to having supplies and equipment coming up on mules?
No, that's a saga in itself, Harry. I mean, you've got your rear echelons. The RASC take it up to the A echelon, who in turn take it to B echelon, who then take it up to a forward position on three tonners, who transfer it to 1,500 ways, who travel, then put it on jeeps, who take it up to a very, very near forward position, who put it on mules, who carry it halfway up the mountains, and the rest of the way, it's somebody with a hump. Basuto warriors were the ones chosen for to carry our supplies at Casino. That's how we were supplied.
These were Indians, were they?
From Africa.
Africa,
Basutos.
Were they using mules?
Oh, yes. Oh, we used a lot of mules in Italy.
Did you use them in the...
Oh, yes. Yes, we used them.
Did you find them?
I think our muleteers did well. I knew one or two of the lads who were drafted. Do you know anything about horses? Yes, well, you're in the mules. Go and take the mules over. And one or two of them, they'd been muleteers in North Africa. You know. And that was the job. I think one or two got the job of going to Africa and buying mules for up in the mountains of Italy. Because you just can't move vehicles in parts of Italy, not in the mountains.
So you're very dependent upon those mules.
Yes. I tell you what, Harry. I've been on holiday recently. I saw a map of Italy. A little tiny wee cart tracks which used to link farm to farm where we made them into roads, where our engineers made roads. Well, those little car tracks are all motorways now. The routes we took, you know, it's exactly the same. They've just made them into roads.
After you got over the Sangro,
yes.
Where did you move after that?
Well, we were relieved by the 8th Indian Div, and we were pulled back about 3 miles, and we were put into little villages where there was some form of shelter.
Was this at rest? Was this a rest position?
Well, we were out the line, but we were in it, you see. But at this juncture, you know, it was pretty quiescent along the front. I mean, the Germans are not going to be upset. They've got good bunkers and everything. And I think they were reasonably happy. There was very little happened. We had one or two sorties with ski patrols that came down from the mountains and shut up some lads in the Irish Brigade who were queuing up for to get their meals, and they shut them up. There was one little place I was at called Capricotta, and the lads made themselves as comfortable as possible. They blocked the holes up where the... Because the Germans had left signs on the various buildings. "Tommy, we hope you like your winter billets," in English. And course, we blocked up the holes and we utilised as keep as warm as possible. Some of the lads, however, will burn charcoal on fires. And I went into one room and none of them spoke to me. And I suddenly realised what had happened and I pulled them all outside. They were getting asphyxiated.